Discretionary listener participation is advised for the following pro wrestling podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. This is the Stick to Wrestling podcast, where if you give us 60 minutes, perhaps indeed, we'll give you a raw bone and wicked good podcast. We primarily talk about pro wrestling from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We have been talking about the World Wrestling Federation, fall of 1983. This is going to be our fourth and final episode doing that. I feel like we've turned into a podcast exclusively dedicated to that promotion during that time period. But look, we had a lot going on. We had a lot of audio. I don't mean to overdo this, but it's the end of the era. I had said before that this was the last time we were going to do a seasonal look at the WWF, but that's actually changed. I'm actually thinking about doing seasonal recaps starting in 1974. So that's on the table. As far as the WWF goes, like 40 years ago, starting January 1984, we're going to do it instead of seasonally, we're going to do it monthly because we have a lot of audio and 1984, my God, there's a lot to talk about. Before I get rolling, I want to invite you to join me, to follow me on Twitter or X, whatever it's called. Just search John McAdam and follow the guy who has the Stick to Wrestling logo as his avatar. If you would like to donate to the Stick to Wrestling podcast, which is free to listen to and ad-free, you can PayPal me at prowrestlingarchives@gmail.com. I will thank you on the show if you do so. And I want to bring on Steve Generelli. Steve, can you please tell the fans about our Facebook group?
Oh, absolutely. We're getting lots of great feedback about the WWF series of episodes, the great miniseries we've been doing. There is a great question from George Capture Jr., who had a great topic asking all of us about our experiences attending those great four-hour WWF TV tapings. So we have some good feedback on that.
Oh, I want to talk about that when you're done. Go ahead.
Okay. S.K. Lee defended Vince Russo's booking, saying that most of the worst ideas and angles came after his departure. And then last but not least, Baron Rodriguez asked, why didn't Mil Máscaras upend Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA belt in Chicago in 1980 instead of Vern winning the belt?
Oh, God, because Vern ran the promotion. He owned the promotion. He got to decide who the champion was. He decided he wanted it to be him.
Pretty much, in a nutshell.
So anyway, in 1991, I can't believe this was 32 years ago, I did back-to-back nights of WWF TV tapings. And
Wow. It
was like taking on a dare, Steve. The first night, it was a Tuesday in Worcester, Massachusetts, and it was long. They did a Saturday night's main event. The whole thing took like 5.5 hours, and I'm not exaggerating. The next day, I drive up to Portland, Maine, for night number two of the WWF TV tapings. This wasn't as bad. It was like 4 hours, but my friends and I were just like, we were already burned out from the night before. So finally, these things end. I jump in my car, ready to head home, and this girl jumps in my car in the passenger seat. I know what's up, right? You know what's up too, right, Steve?
I have no clue.
It rhymes with the word prostitute.
Okay, all right.
And I start cracking up. I just start howling in front of this girl. I think it's funny. And I'm the one who's supposed to be freaked out. Girl jumps in my car. I don't know this person. I turn the tables on her, not even trying to, by laughing at her. I'm just like, no, I'm good. I got a girlfriend. Thanks a lot. She's like, okay, bye. I was the one who was supposed to be freaked out. I'm sure, like, she's done this a million times. She freaked a million guys out. And I'm proud to say I turned the tables on her, and I'm sure she's a listener. I remember you, whatever your name is.
Well, hopefully she earned some big bucks that night.
Yeah, from all those rich wrestling fans pouring out of the Cumberland County Civic Center. I don't know why I did that. Not with the girl, but like, you know, I would think that one set of WWF TV tapings would be enough. But no, I had to, you know, let's go for the, what is it, Superstars of Wrestling. And what was the other one?
Wrestling Challenge.
Wrestling Challenge. Yeah, that was my own wrestling challenge. But anyway, I wanted to continue WWF Fall of 1983 because we took a bunch of questions from people. And after three shows of doing this, we couldn't get around to the questions. So we'll finish up with a bunch of questions. Steve, I'll tell you what, can you select a question? We have a lot of good ones.
Absolutely. And to make it easy on both of us, I think I'll just start from the top of the list and work our way down.
Sure.
So the first one that I have is from Nathaniel Uselton. He's asking, was there any talk at the time of Hulk Hogan jumping to the WWF in a very short time from now? And what do you think, John, on that one?
Well, I mean, I had no idea. If there was a resource for wrestling information, I tapped into it, but I wasn't aware of the newsletters, so all I knew is what I saw on TV, what I read in the magazines, and I had no clue Hulk Hogan was coming to the WWF. And I'll go a step further. I figured he would probably come back at some point as a bad guy to have a series against Bob Backlund. And I knew, he was immensely popular in the AWA, so he probably didn't have to come to the WWF. But if he was coming back, some guys were just bad guys in one territory and good guys in another territory. And I figured, if we saw Hogan again, he'd be back with Fred Blassie, challenging Hulk, Bob Backlund. And obviously, I didn't know what I was talking about. And if they did that, it would have further turned the fans on Bob Backlund, which was already a problem heading into 1984.
Yeah, and for the fans that don't know this story, there was a story that has been told by Greg Gagne that they received a telegram, I think at the start of December, stating that it came from Tampa, Florida, and it basically said that Hulk Hogan would not be coming back to the AWA. And supposedly, Greg and Vern both scoffed at this. They thought it was like an insider joke from Eddie Graham that he had sent it up to them. But when Hogan wasn't returning their calls and he was starting to miss house shows, they realized that this was really happening before their very eyes. And but apparently, like you say, none of the insider people, none of the Dave Meltzers or the other people around at that time knew about this. So it was really a true shock in the wrestling business.
It was. The story I heard was that Hogan sent a telegram to the AWA notifying them that he wasn't coming back after his Japan tour. So this is probably more like late October, early November. Mm-hmm. And the Gagnes continued to advertise Hulk Hogan. And I am more inclined to think that, they would just do that in order to bait and switch a crowd rather than just acknowledge that Hulk Hogan was gone, it's easier to say, we didn't believe it and we continued to advertise Hogan than just to say, we just left Hulk Hogan on the advertisements anyway, knowing he wasn't coming up.
Yeah, I agree. Why don't you hit me with a question there?
All right. From Brandon Rice, because I have an answer to this one. What were some of the angles or programs you wanted to see or hoped to see by the end of 1983? I've got a couple.
Okay. At the time, going back that far, I didn't really, think that way. Like, gee, this is one I really want to see.
Really?
If I was thinking, via the magazines, like people I had seen in other territories, I always wanted to see Terry Funk come in and get a big run. I always felt he was the one real standout, other than a Nick Bockwinkel, who you knew wasn't going to come in because he was always the champion over there. I really wanted to see Terry Funk against whoever, whether it was Backlund or another top star.
Terry Funk was supposed to come in 1980, and I forget what happened. I got to look at his book again, but he was, all but advertised in the After magazines as coming in, and he never came in. And, when Mark Nolte was still around, he asked me during a phone conversation, would Terry Funk have gotten over in the WWF? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. First of all, Terry Funk got over wherever he went. When he came in 1985 against against Hogan. Now we're talking Terry Funk, who is 5 years older and significantly smaller than Hogan, smaller than a lot of the heels. He got over like crazy. So, of course, he would have gotten over in 1980. The guys I really wanted to see, and Steve, I'm actually a little bit surprised that like there was nothing that you kind of, I don't want to say fantasized about, but you know, thought you might want to see. Like as soon as Morocco came back to the WWF, like I wanted to see him in the ring against Jimmy Snuka, and Lord knows we got that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, before Ric Flair won the NWA title, I totally wanted him to come to the WWF and challenge Backlund. Even though, you know, I figured he wasn't going to win, I would have loved to see him just go through a tour here. But to answer Brandon's question, it looked to me at this time in 1983 that the Freebirds were finishing up in world class. Okay, mm-hmm. They weren't, but by this point, I thought they should have, and they didn't because they were still drawing, as I didn't know back then. But I would have loved to see the Freebirds come to the WWF, you know, have them win the tag team titles and install the Freebird rule where the challengers never knew which two Freebirds they'd be wrestling on that night. And they did that with the Valiant Brothers in 79, so... And, you know, again, you could have had Michael Hayes against Bob Backlund. You could have had Terry Gordy against Bob Backlund. Maybe Buddy Roberts in, like, you know, the smaller arenas, like the one in Manchester, New Hampshire. I think that would have been a great run. The second one, actually the first one, and I just mentioned how some wrestlers were heels in one territory and babyfaces in the other. And a guy named Roddy Piper had his pattern. He would show up in a territory as a heel, and then he would turn babyface. I would have loved to have seen Roddy Piper come up here and do exactly that, and maybe as a babyface Roddy Piper eventually become the guy who replaced Backlund. This, believe it or not, this was going through my head in 1983. So those are my two. Do you have one, Steve?
Well, not really, but I will piggyback on something you said. In retrospect, I mean, we know what happened with the Freebirds' very, very, very brief run in 1984. Do you think, in retrospect, John, that had the Freebirds been maybe had they arrived, say, at the end of '83, like what we're talking about now, do you think they would have been maybe more effective being paired up with an Albano or even a Blassie? Do you think that might have made them more feel more welcome on the East Coast?
That is a good question. I remember Jesse Ventura maybe 20 years ago complaining that Fred Blassie was his manager in the WWF. And, you know, Jesse Ventura was an excellent talker and he felt like he didn't need a manager. And that's just the way it went up here that, you know, if you wanted to be taken seriously as a heel, you had a manager. Everyone had one with the exception of Larry Zbysko, and that's because he turned. And I think if Larry Zbysko had come back in 1983, which I thought was going to happen, but never did, he would have had a manager. But now we're talking about the Freebirds. And it's a faction. Like, Michael Hayes is the guy representing Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts. So they may have been the exception, especially when you consider that the Grand Wizard had just passed away. So Right. Maybe there's an alternate universe where the WWF doesn't expand, they have the Freebirds come up, and Michael Hayes is the de facto replacement for the Grand Wizard.
Well, that's a good point. And much like how Roddy Piper in the beginning of '84 was kind of a manager for David Schultz and Paul Orndorff, maybe Michael Hayes could have been the manager of the Freebirds, and maybe he would have even taken on a couple of other charges. Who knows?
I mean, he was, again, the de facto manager for Killer Khan in both Mid-South and eventually in world class. So, yeah, you could have done it that way. Obviously, I don't think that would have been not a long-term thing. I think that could have lasted about a year, and by then it was time to get another real manager in. But, you know, things were going to change radically in the WWF. And, I mean, you know, the Grand Wizard, you know, them having those three managers, like, that was going to change anyway. It had been that way forever. It had been that way since 1974 when Fred Blassie retired.
Yeah, so that's 10 full years, really. So they were due for a change.
They were definitely due for a change. I mean, it worked. It was the way they did things. But I mean, Bobby Heenan, in his book, talked about how every 6 months he would call Vince Sr. and say, hey, you know, do you have a spot for me? And Vince Sr. would say, you know, no, not yet. And then came the time he called Vince Jr., I want to say early 84, and instead of hearing, you know, no, not right now, Vince McMahon Jr. said something like, yeah, we're going to have something for you soon.
Yeah, right. And there he was at the Garden managing Big John Studd against Hogan.
Yeah, that Roddy Piper actually managed Big John Studd for a while, which was weird.
That's
but you're
true.
Right. He was the manager of Dr. D. David Schultz and Paul Orndorff for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll talk a lot about this when the 84 shows start. But a lot of people act like, you know, the WWF under Vince Jr. was this well-planned, well-oiled machine, and I'm telling you it wasn't. Before WrestleMania 3, I swear Vince would just throw spaghetti against the wall and whatever, and he would see what would stick. And that was the end of it. I mean, you could tell going back and watching some of this stuff, a lot of it is really poorly planned. He just rolled stuff out there.
Well, also to give credit to the talent, I think that these guys, you know, so many of them had worked so many multiple territories, and their act was so seasoned, and they were quite versatile. That they could do things on the fly. They could think fast on their feet. These wrestlers were really, you know, the complete opposite of today's wrestlers that need to be, you know, have a producer to produce them and all that. But once the territory era was over with, you know, these guys that had learned so much and had such great skill sets and talent sets and repertoire of moves, once that was all over and done with, just throwing guys up against the blackboard or, you know, throwing angles together became much more difficult because the guys were much more limited that came down after that in the 90s and beyond.
Yeah, that became a major problem in pro wrestling. Like Vince used to be able to use the territories as almost his minor league feeder system. And then when they all died and it was just Vince and WCW, I mean, he was picking up guys from indies, and guys who I had never heard of were coming in and getting big pushes, or guys I had barely heard of. And, you know, this is after really WCW had dried up. And it was like, you know, and what a coincidence the wrestling business went downhill, because there was nowhere for Vince to grab new stars from. And the guys who he was grabbing from indies just weren't seasoned enough.
Yeah, but to his credit, I mean, his team of people he had working for him, even in the 90s, I mean, they could take a guy who never really had reached, you know, the level of success, like, we'll use Scott Hall as an example. I mean, Scott Hall in the AWA was terrible. His Starship Eagle, he was terrible. His Diamond Stud, he had potential. And then giving him the Razor Ramon role and all the stuff that they did to kind of bring him to the top. I mean, the little tweaks here and tweaks there. He became a full-fledged superstar. I mean, so the machine he had behind him and all the Pat Patterson's and the people that worked with him, they definitely knew how to elevate guys who maybe weren't so elevated before.
You know, I remember 92 watching WWF wrestling, and they had the Razor Ramon vignettes on, right?
Right.
And then they announced that Razor Ramon is in the main event at the Boston Garden, and he hadn't even wrestled on TV yet.
Right.
And part of me was like, look, the business is changing, and this is one of the changes that, you know, they just bring a guy in and they put him on top right away without even having wrestled on television. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, why do I want to go see this guy in the main event if he hasn't accomplished anything except a couple of vignettes? At the end of the day, I thought that part made more sense. You had to turn him into a star before anointing him as a star. And they just anointed him as a star. And what do you know? The attendance, you know, plummeted in 1992. Not just because of that. There were other reasons. Believe me, 1992 was rough. But it was just the wrong formula, in my opinion.
Well, I remember in the New York market, they announced a special main event. It was going to be Randy Savage at MSG against Razor Ramon. And I almost felt like the opposite way. I just felt like this is a marquee matchup. This is like a brand new star that has just like emerged against Randy Savage, who's so, you know, long-term established star. And it felt like this is the kind of a match the Garden wanted to see. And you know, over time, I guess that proved to be correct, because it didn't take long for him to really catch on and become one of the key stars, especially since the Federation as a whole had really kind of dried up quite a bit as far as people that the fans really wanted to see.
The business as a whole had dried up. I remember having a conversation with Bill Apter, right? And Bill mm-hmm. Apter was obviously, this is in 1984, and he was as anti-WWF as it got, you know, for good reason. And Bill Apter was arguing that Hulk Hogan had no business getting a title match against the Iron Sheik, because what had he done in the WWF? And my take on it was that, you know, but it's not just about what he did in the WWF. I mean, he was a big star in the AWA. He was a big star in St. Louis. He was established, even though he hadn't been established in the WWF.
Right.
Scott Hall hadn't established anything anywhere, and we got the same main event you did. It was Randy mm-hmm. Savage defending the title against Razor Ramon. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you know, this Razor Ramon guy has done literally nothing, and I wasn't going to go to see that match anyway, but I certainly wasn't going to go see it under those circumstances. But again, I get it. The wrestling business was changing, and you bring in a guy, and you give him the big splash push, like they did with Hogan. But, I mean, like I said, it didn't work, at least right away, with Scott Hall.
Yeah, but it didn't take too long either. I mean, Razor Ramon became you know, one of those names that was synonymous with the WWF in the early to mid 90s.
Sure.
They really didn't have many. I mean, they didn't have too many big names by that point.
No, and I would have told you, I certainly don't know everything. And when they turned Razor Ramon, I'm like, you guys are crazy. This is never getting over. And just like Brutus Beefcake before him, I was dead wrong.
Yeah, well, believe me, we're all wrong from time to time. But hey, I got another question for you. This one is Michael Hulse, and he's asking, I've always heard Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson didn't like each other. Any idea why? What issues did lead to this?
Well, a couple of things. This is something I hate the answer to this question, but I have the answer. Number one, for more than one source, I mean, Rocky Johnson just wasn't that cool a guy. But number two, back in 1983, and I hate this, okay? Mm-hmm. Being black was almost a gimmick in wrestling. It was. And I hate it, but it's true. That's the way the promoters used it. And it was almost like the way Chief J. Strongbow got a little bit jealous of Billy White Wolf. It was the guys felt like there was one spot in each promotion for every black wrestler, and they all saw one another as a threat and thus didn't get along. And
right.
I mean, Tony Atlas talked about it on one of the WWF sit-down shows, which is available on Peacock. But, I mean, if it's coming from Tony, I believe it.
Well, also, too, you know, I've heard stories that Rocky Johnson liked to do some kind of questionable things, like supposedly
stealing people's cars, like,
yeah,
that,
like
kind
SD,
of questionable.
Yeah, like SD Jones had a car and Rocky Johnson borrowed it and then wanted to sell it. And
yes.
So and you know, and Tony Ellis, I think, had a real nice relationship with SD Jones. They were friendly friends, and you know, if that really happened, you know, that is going to create friction between two guys who are supposedly partners and the best of friends, and also. You know, just the natural competitive jealousies that two people would have. I mean, like you said, in wrestling, there were such limited spots for black athletes. Rocky Johnson was the more experienced, the more skilled, the more veteran, and he probably felt rightfully, this is my spot. But Tony Atlas had been a bigger star in New York just a few years earlier, and his physique was massive and probably even a little more impressive than Rocky's, even though Rocky had a great physique. So you could just imagine the professional jealousy going on there. This guy's younger than me. He's bigger than me, but maybe he shouldn't be getting the push. He's not as good of a wrestler as me. So all these things are kind of like pulling and pushing at each other.
I can totally see each guy thinking that the other guy was taking his spot, because you're right. Tony Atlas came in 1979. He left. He came back in 81. He was here in 82. Tony is looking at Rocky coming in fall of 1982 as, hey, that's my spot. Then Tony comes back in 1983, and Rocky's looking at it saying, hey, he's taking my spot. And then they're pairing the two of them up. And by the way, I have heard that Tony and SD Jones were good friends. Nothing against SD Jones, but he was not a threat to anyone's spot.
That is true. And I think also Rocky probably looked at Tony Atlas and Tony, you know, had many great skills, being a super intelligent guy. Maybe it wasn't one of them. I think Rocky Johnson looked down on Tony as maybe not being as cultured or as well-versed in the political machinations of wrestling. I think he probably felt he was smarter at dealing with promoters and working the business. Tony at times just seemed lost, like that he would be taken advantage of by promoters, where Rocky was more skilled in that regard. So I think there was a little disrespect from each other to both of the partners.
I mean, there are crazy Tony Atlas stories out there. I mean, Ricky Steamboat told a story where he first came into Mid-Atlantic Wrestling and they gave him the name Tony Atlas, and they wanted him to, you know, they really wanted to push him, and, you know, they put him out there against some veteran, and they said, Tony, we really want you to shine out there. Go out there, and want you to really shine. And Tony, like, you know, was on defense for most of the match. You know, he took a beating, wound up getting the pin, and whoever the promoter or booker was said, Tony, we told you to go out there and shine tonight. What happened? And Tony's like, I put on a whole bottle of baby oil. And then this story came right from Ricky Steamboat, who was in the dressing room. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson, in 1983, I saw both of them as guys who could win the NWA championship, especially Tony Atlas, since he was younger.
Yeah. Yeah. But Rocky Johnson, definitely, if it wasn't such an old boys network, Rocky Johnson should have been considered in the 70s for sure, because he really, there wasn't anything he couldn't do. But he was a little long on the tooth by this point, 83, 84.
You see, I didn't see that. I never looked at Rocky Johnson and said, wow, he seems kind of old. And by this point, I started doing that more often. Like, Ivan Koloff looked kind of old in 1983.
He did.
Rocky Johnson, you know, I never said that. Like, wow, this guy looks old. What I was saying the year before is, what is Rocky Johnson doing in Portland? He is too big a star to be wrestling in, you know, not a second-rate promotion by any means, but, you know, you made a lot more money in Florida, Georgia, Mid-Atlantic, WWF, and, you know, finally he got out of Portland. But anyway, let me pick a question. Jay Bowser, don't you think a big Sergeant Slaughter versus Pedro Morales feud was a missed opportunity? I think it was. I think it would have been a tremendous brawl. Steve, they had some matches in 1981, but I mean, what, do you think they missed the boat on not having a Slaughter versus Morales program?
Yeah, you know, had they had it, it would have been fine. But I mean, like, looking back on some of these feuds, like, there was a feud between Greg Valentine and Pedro Morales, and they tried to make it, you know, special. They had Valentine hurt Morales on the floor on TV, and
that was hilarious.
Yeah, and they did things like that. But that's definitely not a memorable feud. I'm sure they would have had some brawls and things, but and I'm sure it would have been okay, but I don't think it would have really, you know, been one that we'd be talking about all these years later.
Your answer is my answer, Steve. I don't think they really missed the boat. I think it's something they could have done, and it would have been fine. I mean, Morales defended the Intercontinental Championship against Slaughter at Madison Square Garden, Philadelphia, Boston, and that's as far as it went. But when they were together in the WWF, when they were both in the WWF in 1981, like you said, Pedro Morales was feuding with Greg Valentine, and the feud started when Valentine suplexed Morales outside the ring, and Pedro went into convulsions on the concrete floor, which had me scream laughing when, as it occurred. It was so preposterous. And then in 81, you had the Pat Patterson versus Sergeant Slaughter feud, which was the feud. So you know what? I wouldn't have traded Pedro Morales versus Sergeant Slaughter, you know, and give up Pat Patterson versus Slaughter. And then Morales more or less disappeared from the WWF in the beginning of 1983 when he lost the Intercontinental Championship to Morocco. And then Slaughter came back, I want to say late in the spring, and Morales didn't come back until 1985. So, yeah, I mean, you know, their paths never really crossed except for those one-and-done Intercontinental title matches. And like I said, I just don't see, like, you know, once again, when Morocco came back, I'm like, wow, natural feud's about to happen with Jimmy Snuka. I just didn't see Morales versus Slaughter in that light.
Yeah, and to give Jay credit, I think, like what John just described, it was just a case of they weren't in the same place at the same time. Morales left early 83, Slaughter returned to mid 83, and then had they been there together, maybe it would have happened.
Yeah, exactly. And had, you know, let's say Sergeant Slaughter had a brief run, a Superstar Graham-type run with the WWF title, I'd be wanting to see Pedro Morales back in the WWF challenge for the title under those circumstances.
No, absolutely. And
I've mentioned on the show before, I mean, Pedro Morales, I'll never understand why he didn't come in 1977 to challenge Superstar Billy Graham. That is conspicuous by its absence, as Vince McMahon would say.
Well, you know, maybe they still had that feeling of Pedro, even though he'll pop a big house and he'll do well at the Garden. Maybe they felt that could be a recipe for a riot at the Garden. You know, Pedro against Superstar and the fans erupt.
You know, I'm going to talk about this. There was talk about Superstar Graham won the title from Bruno in Baltimore so that there wouldn't be a riot. And then this happened so that there wouldn't be a riot. When was the last riot? In like 1960? Okay, I mean, why are we running from these riots when they never happen? I saw a near, not even a near riot. I saw a near riot in Louisville, and this is when we were there as part of Smoky Mountain Fan Week, and the SMW guys turned on the USWA guys, and the fans were close enough to rioting where you're like, okay, this isn't cool. Brian Last was there, by the way. And in the Boston Garden, I saw enough heat during the Strongbows versus Fuji and Saito when Fuji and Saito won in like 30 seconds. Everyone thought the match was over. And the fans, you know, the temperature rose to the point where it was a little bit uncomfortable. But that was it. Nothing ever happened beyond that at the Boston Garden. And, you know, I just don't know why we're taking all of these anti-riot measures. When was the last riot? They don't happen.
Well, I think that, you know, Vince, the elder Vince was a true gentleman, well-respected within the business. I think that he probably took quite offense to the fact that wrestling, which he was very proud of, and it was all over the New York papers in 1958. The four of them were,
yes, it was,
lined up there. And, you know, it was just kind of a black eye for the business, I guess. I mean, there was the stabbing of Black Jack Mulligan in 1971 at Boston Garden. Maybe he just did not want to see another bloody thing where a wrestler got hurt, or maybe fans got hurt, or just something that would give the promotion a black eye. Because the promotion was certainly, you know, probably one of the most well-respected within the industry and from the outside.
That Blackjack Mulligan thing was the craziest thing ever. That fan, I mean, I really hope there's an alternate universe where Blackjack Mulligan killed that guy. The guy didn't just stab Blackjack Mulligan. He dipped the knife in pig blood and pig grease, and then he stabbed Blackjack Mulligan. So with the intent of infecting him and killing him. So it's really wild. I mean, what an idiot. And Steve, have you seen the Cleveland riot with Ernie Ladd, Ox Baker, and Johnny Powers?
If I did, it was a long time ago. I know of it, but I don't remember watching it, honestly.
I believe it's on YouTube, and if you guys want to see what a scary wrestling riot looks like, you want to check this out. It's something you just would not want to be part of. I mean, chairs are flying, people are going after Ernie Ladd. It was nuts. It was just something you want to see.
Well, let me hit you with a question here.
All right.
Dusty Hansen is asking, there's pictures of Vince at Hulk Hogan's wedding in the Japanese Gong magazines. How long do you think they've been talking and planning the big run?
I don't know. I think probably Vince had it in his head even before he took over the company in 1982 that, look, this Hulk Hogan guy has a lot more under the hood than Bob Backlund. I mean, it's just that simple. He has a lot more star power, and he belongs in New York, not in the AWA. But that's pure speculation on my part. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I remember some fans that used to go to the Allentown TV tapings had said one time at the tapings, they were looking in the back. The matches hadn't started yet, but they were looking in the back trying to see who was there, and they saw this huge blonde guy, and they were really hoping it was superstar Billy Graham coming back. But when they looked and they finally found out who it was, they found out it was Hulk Hogan. And, I think that was kind of the inclination I think Vince had. He knew that the old superstar of old was gone, but who would be the next best thing? And Hulk Hogan had more size than Billy. He really had maybe potentially a better body. It was certainly a bigger body, but it was a very muscular body, blonde hair, tan. Maybe the outfits weren't as good as Billy's outfits, but he could see. I think Vince in his mind could see this young Hulk Hogan developing into the mid '80s version of what Billy Graham once was, and somehow he did make it happen. He maybe through what he learned under Vern, and he learned a lot in Japan too. And then Vince knew how to push him with the right marketing and the right look with his, the red and the yellow and the marketing. I think that's, whether they knew about it at the wedding or maybe Vince knew about it in the early 80s, I think it was something Vince probably had been thinking about for a long time. And just this perfect window came into being of, maybe Hulk was tired of Vern taking too much money off the top, not giving him enough merchandising money. There are issues about going to Japan and getting that money. And now Vince is going to overpay him, essentially, to have him. But what do you think, John? What's your take on that?
Well, Steve, as soon as you said superstar Billy Graham had a better wardrobe, like it went right through my head. I'm like, he really didn't, because Hulk Hogan had that T-shirt. And if you like that T-shirt, just go to the concession area and you can have one of your own. Oh, you're not going to the matches? Here's where you can mail away for one.
Good thinking there, John.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's exactly what Vince McMahon was thinking, that, he wanted that merchandising to be out there. And my understanding is that the shirts sold really well. The Hulk Hogan shirts sold really well. The other ones, hit and miss. But, Hogan's merchandising made a lot of money for a lot of people. Okay, this goes back to fall of 1983. Christian Bode asks, is there any way that Bob Backlund could have stayed champion, or did Vince have his mind made up? What are your thoughts, Steve?
No, there was no way Backlund could have stayed champion. I mean, the only way that it would have stayed the way would be if the elder Vince didn't sell the company. If he kept the company. I think he wanted to have Backlund be a champion for as long as possible, really. But with Vince as the owner, young Vince as the owner, there was no way in hell, as his entrance theme says, there was no way in hell that Bob was going to remain champion. Vince was all about color and excitement and showbiz. Bob Backlund was certainly not showbiz, so he got Hulk Hogan, probably the best showbiz wrestler or entertainer, and we know what happened after that.
I agree with everything you said. I'm going to answer Christian's question in a different way.
Okay.
Let's say Vince Sr. never sells the company. Okay. Let's say it's fall 1983, mm-hmm. and he's still running it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Backlund is champion. The WWF is still doing well. And let's say Vince Sr. had no intention of going national. He was happy being south to Maryland, north to Maine, right?
Mm-hmm.
The time had come for Backlund to lose the title by fall of 1983.
Mm-hmm.
He had been champion for 6 years, and someone could argue that, hey, they were still drawing. They needed to get ahead of it. I really believe, Steve, I have no way of proving it. No one has any way of proving it wrong. It's all speculation. But by summer of 1984, I really believe that Snuka would have cooled off, the Federation would have cooled off, and the crowds would have gone into decline because the product was stale. And I think they needed something new at the top. Bob had a great six-year run, okay? 6 years. That's mm-hmm. a long time. And you're just asking a lot for the fans to be okay with year number seven of the same guy and the same formula. And I think they needed to get Bob out of there. And again, that's me praising Bob. He was champion for 6 years, and they were still drawing at the end of his reign. But, you know, the time I really felt had come for something new, and I think if they had tried to ride Bob much longer, the rent would have become due on it. The crowds would have started going down. The interest would have started going down. Bob had become stale, and it was time for something else. So even without Hulk Hogan, again, I think it was time for the WWF to move on from Bob Backlund.
Well, I've got a question that kind of dovetails right into what you just said.
Can I throw something in here too, Steve? Even if Bob had not gotten the crew cut and had not started wearing the singlet and his interviews hadn't started going backwards, even if we still had 1979, 1980 Bob Backlund, even that would have gotten stale. It was time for something new. I'm sorry, Steve. Go ahead.
No, so I do have a question that kind of dovetails in with what you just said. Tim Tetro is asking, if Piper, Orndorff, and Schultz came in as opponents for Backlund during this time, could that have revitalized him as champion and possibly delayed the Hogan era a year or a couple of months at least?
I mean, the plan definitely was for Paul Orndorff to be the opponent for Bob Backlund January 1984. I mean, Schultz came in as part of the package with Hulk Hogan and Gene Okerlund. I mean, could they have revitalized him as champ and delayed Hogan? I mean, you're right, dovetailing back to what I said, they could have put it off, but there was no reason to. I mean,
right.
I think what they did was the smartest thing. They bring Hogan in, and they put the title on him right away. And again, I know what I just said about Razor Ramon. I think it's a different circumstance. And there was no reason to put off the Hulk Hogan era. You know, there's none whatsoever. It's like putting off your vacation for no reason, making right. your vacation shorter for no reason. What do you
right.
think, Steve?
No, absolutely. I mean, we've been talking about it for a long time. I mean, Backlund had a very good run. There's not very many wrestlers you could say had a run as successful as Bob Backlund's run. I mean, he faced a who's who of challengers, very, very successful in the biggest markets in the country. All the power to him for pulling it off, but I mean, there comes a time when, I mean, you can't listen to the same 12 songs. I mean, you need to change the album once in a while.
There you go. Excellent point.
You know, he was great, but, you know, it was time for something else.
You know, I remember the first time when I was like 7 or 8 years old, I first started listening to the radio, and like there would, you know, a song would get on the radio and it would become number one, and then it would start to slide down the charts and you didn't hear it on the radio anymore. It was like that. And that's, you know, how it goes. Everything has its time and place, and Bob's time and place was just gone. Thomas Bain asked, Jimmy Snuka gets arrested and then convicted of her murder. Does that slow or stop Vince's expansion? I think not in 1983, Thomas, but in 1998 or 1999, Vince Russo certainly could have made a convicted murderer the world's heavyweight champion and capitalized on that on TV. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I mean, I know it's a topic we've kind of covered already, and I know you definitely had a very good comment on one of the previous shows that it's almost like the Chris Benoit thing. Would we blame the WWE for what happened with Chris Benoit? It seemed like whatever Jimmy Snuka did happened on his own time. It wasn't something related to wrestling. He just did what he did. It was a very unfortunate incident. It definitely would have hurt the WWF, their brand, and would have been a PR black eye. But even if it had been a bigger deal, like Vince ultimately did, they would have marched on and gotten through it, and they would. It really wouldn't have affected them too much in the big picture of things.
No, it wouldn't have. I think, we've seen, like the New England Patriots, that Aaron Hernandez murdered somebody, at
Sure.
least one person. And the Patriots handled it well, and no one turned around and blamed the Patriots. And they just, divorced themselves from the guy, and I think that's what would have happened with Jimmy Snuka. John Ware asks, what happens if All American Wrestling tanks on USA Network? Steve, I don't think it would have made a difference.
Well, I mean, to that point, they had already been on USA Network for, I think, going back to about 1980. Those MSG shows started. I think the shows from Landover may have started around 82, 83, probably 82. There was a whole bunch of Backlund defenses on from USA Network and Landover. Yeah, the All American show was essentially just a wrap-up show with lots of second-run clips from the syndicated shows. I don't think it would have tanked because I mean, none of the other shows tanked. I mean, they had shows on all kinds of syndicated stations, and they did well. And the fact that, these house shows and also the All American did good enough, it definitely gave USA an opportunity to say, hey, could you even do more programming for us? And that's where Vince came in with TNT and eventually came in with Primetime Wrestling. So, I mean, USA Network in those days was a very, very, kind of a primitive channel. I mean, they wanted to be a sports channel, and they wanted to have variety and movies and all kinds of different things. But they were really hurting for programming, and the WWF was really hurting for a place to air their programming. So it was a kind of a match made in heaven.
I mean, I believe I said this on one of the previous shows where we talked about WWF Spring, excuse me, Fall 1983. I mean, USA Network was broadcasting junk that was airing on UHF stations in the mid-afternoon in the 70s. That's how desperate for programming they were. So, and the WWF wanted a national outlet for their Tuesday Night Titan show. So it all worked really well together as time went on.
Oh, absolutely. Here, I've got another question for you. This time it's Les Takix asking, what happened with Don Kernodle? The guy comes from a white-hot angle teaming with Slaughter directly to jobbing. Was he just that unremarkable without Slaughter?
Les, that is an all-timer of a mystery. I mean, it really was. To this day, I have no idea why. Now, you have Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle, NWA World Tag Team Champions. Kernodle is kind of the Robin to Slaughter's Batman. And then they come up to the WWF. It's not acknowledged that never acknowledged that they had any relationship, but they show up at the same time, and Slaughter obviously gets as big a push as a heel got in this era, and Kernodle literally never wins a match on TV. Wins a couple at the arenas, but is literally just another guy. And I don't know why he came up here, if just, he was friends with Slaughter and Slaughter needed someone to drive him around. I have no idea. But the whole thing made no sense. Kernodle was an outstanding worker, so they could have at least used him as maybe a middle-of-the-card role, especially coming off his success as, one of the NWA Tag Team Champions. But no, he came up and was just strictly a bottom-of-the-card guy who never won on TV. I'll never understand what happened there.
Well, I think part of it might be, I mean, Don Kernodle was a local guy in Charlotte. And I think, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic territory, having a local boy from Charlotte get a big push with Sergeant Slaughter, that makes perfect sense. And they really hit it off perfectly in Mid-Atlantic. You know, I compare Don Kernodle, I guess, to like maybe Terry Daniels. I mean, putting Terry Daniels is kind of like the, Robin to Sergeant Slaughter as Batman. Together, they seem like, a good team in that regard. Like, this is a big guy and he's got a little buddy and, that seems to work out. But Don Kernodle, just on his own, he just seemed like a Charlie Fulton, a guy who was a good journeyman wrestler, could give you a good match, but just wasn't going to be put in any kind of programs at all.
Charlie Fulton actually got a few wins when he first arrived in the WWF in 1981, and then out of nowhere, he just became a jobber. I mean, it looked like he was getting a mid-card push, and just bang, nope, he's a jobber. Kernodle didn't even get that. I mean, you would think, based on what they did in the Carolinas, just bring him in as Sergeant Slaughter's lackey or something like that. You know, use him in that role. No, they never even acknowledged the relationship. It made no sense. Les, it's a good question. I'm sorry. I don't have an answer. I don't know if there is an answer.
Yeah, there may not be an answer. I mean, this is just a guess, but maybe they knew that, a year from now, Slaughter is going to be a good guy. Maybe they thought Kernodle would just get in the way. So they just had Slaughter be a challenger to Backlund. And he just kind of bided his time until the time to turn was the right time.
All right, let's do one more. We're running out of time. It's always the fastest hour of my week here at the Stick to Wrestling headquarters. I'll do one more question. Brandon Hefner, could Larry Zbysko have been brought back after his run in Georgia as national heavyweight champion, or was that bridge burned for good even then? Steve, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the bridge was burned, really. From what I know, and I know some of this Dave Meltzer had talked about in 84, when Bruno went to talk with Vince and to reconcile over the lawsuit that they had, and Vince was going to pay off Bruno from the back money they owed him from Shea Stadium and things like that. Bruno wanted to bring his son in, which ended up happening. He also wanted to bring in Dominic DiNucci and Larry Zbysko, which did not happen. I think that the promotion, even though Vince Sr. had been had passed away by this time, I think the promotion just didn't want any part of Larry Zbysko. I think there were just some bad feelings about what had happened before, and I think younger Vince just wanted to move on from that. That's my take on it. What's your take, John?
Well, a couple of things. You mentioned that Bruno wanted them to bring back Dominic DiNucci, who Bruno was good friends with, and Larry Zbysko. And 1984, look, I'm sorry, you couldn't have Dominic DiNucci on TV in any role. He just looked too old. He was too old. The Zbysko thing never made sense to me. It never made sense. Without having any inside information or knowledge, Larry Zbysko was conspicuous by his absence by 1983. It was time for him to come back and have a run against Bob Backlund. With Bruno retired, Zbysko was an established star from the Bruno turn. I didn't know what was going on. I always thought the story that Larry Zbysko tells about Shea Stadium and how he held up Vince Sr. for more money, and that's how he got blackballed eventually. The story never adds up because Larry Zbysko was still with the WWF long after the Shea Stadium thing. The Shea Stadium took place, I want to say, October 8th or 9th, 1980. And in November 1980, Larry Zbysko is headlining the Philadelphia Spectrum against Bob Backlund. So the whole thing doesn't add up. There's probably a major piece missing that I might not know about. But, I mean, Larry Zbysko never came back to the WWF until they put him in the Hall of Fame.
Right. That's true.
All right, Steve, final question of the episode. It's all yours.
All right. I think this is a good one. Michael Verone was asking, There is a legendary Starrcade story with Vince trying to flip Harley Race. But what if he went after Flair in 83? Could that have worked? Was Flair not big enough yet? And or was he, as a heel champ, with a face chasing just never in the cards for Vince?
That is a really interesting question. I mean, you know, I don't think Ric Flair would have ever done it. Harley Race talks about it in his book, that he had a meeting with Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon tried to get him to skip Starrcade 83 and come to the WWF, and Harley just couldn't do it. So the question is, what if Vince had gone after Ric Flair? I don't think Ric Flair would have done it either. I mean, Jim Crockett Jr. was part of his wedding party when he married Beth, so I don't think he would have done that to Jim Crockett, but let's say he hired Ric Flair. You know, Ric Flair, let's say he just threw enough money at Ric Flair so he did it, and Rick didn't have that personal relationship with Crockett. I mean, that would have put a major bullet hole in the NWA, and by this time, assuming Crockett and the rest of the NWA promoters are aware of what Vince tried to do with Harley Race, which they had to be, you've got to ask yourself, is that $25,000 deposit enough? Like, you have to have more of an assurance that your champion's not going to skip out on you. So, you know, I don't think Rick had a contract at that point, but, you know, I think they would have had to be really careful of something like that. If Vince tried it once, he was going to try it again.
I agree with you. I think Ric Flair had too much loyalty to the Crockett's. I mean, the new book by Tim Hornbreaker really has a lot of stories in there talking about how good the Crockett family was to Rick, and even in the early days he was having some tax issues and money issues, and they were always right there to kind of bail him out. And I think he felt like a great deal of loyalty to them, and I think he had that feeling towards Charlotte that a lot of the New York guys felt about New York. Or Bruno in Pittsburgh. I mean, it's like that was his home, and I think he had a real loyalty to that area. I don't see him doing it, even if Vince gave him this humongous offer.
No, I can't see him doing it either. But if he was in a position, or if Vince McMahon was in a position to hire away the NWA champion, like here's $25,000 to cover your, you know, to cover the deposit, and just jump to the WWF. I mean, that would have been nothing, and yeah, that would have been a major blow to the NWA as a whole. And I'm sure Vince at some point asked for the sake of asking, "Hey, Rick, would you be interested in this?" And, you know, of course, Rick wouldn't do it. He eventually would, and he was supposed to be, as we mentioned, the surprise at SummerSlam 88. But, you know, I mean, that's a full 5 years later.
You know, it makes for a really kind of interesting fantasy booking. I mean, if that had happened and Flair came in, and let's say like Flair beat Backlund, and then maybe Hogan beat Flair and unified the titles. I mean, that would have been such a humongous way to give birth to the Hogan era. It would be almost distracting to whatever happened afterwards. I mean, to have such a monumental shift like that. And I don't know what Ric Flair's role would have been in 84. Maybe they would have paired him up with Piper in some way, but it might have in some way overshadowed the first WrestleMania. I don't know.
It I'm not sure about that, because WrestleMania was aimed at like the non-wrestling fan.
That's
whereas
true.
The non-wrestling fan wouldn't have gotten Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair. But
right.
Anyway, Steve, I want to thank you for once again being part of the Stick to Wrestling.
Well, it was great to be here with you, and I look forward to our next episode.
I want to thank Brian Last for giving us this podium. I want to thank Lou Kippelman for all the great work he does producing Stick to Wrestling. Next week, tune in to part 5 of our... I'm kidding. Next week, I believe starting next week, we're going to be reviewing a bunch of shows. We've got the anniversary of Starrcade 83 coming up, 35th anniversary of Starrcade 88. 30th anniversary of Starrcade 93. We've got the 40th anniversary of the big world-class Thanksgiving show. So we've got a lot on tap, and we've talked about WWF Fall 83 for the last time. Thank you, everyone, again for listening. And we'll be back next week. This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Go Vols, beat UConn.
This concludes our podcast day.